Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight, my guest is James Fox. Before I bring him on, I want to thank DeleteMe, which is a Boston-based privacy company led by consumer protection, privacy, and identity theft experts. They are passionate about making easy-to-use privacy solutions for everyday people. They strongly believe that the solutions must improve as online privacy becomes more difficult to get. They are a hands-free subscription service that removes consumers' personal and private information from the leading people, search, and data broker websites online. They submit opt-outs on behalf of our subscribers to have these websites taken down, their personal information that is on display for the public. Just click the link in the description and check out that what they can do for you. Also, please subscribe to Forbidden Knowledge News on lbry.com or library.com. We know they are purging channels like mine every day, and one day when you check on YouTube, we may not be here. And all of our content is already on lbry.com, so just be sure to go and subscribe there. Tonight, I want to welcome James Fox. He is a director who began his journalism career early in life as an assistant to his father, writer Charles Fox. Together, they traveled on many magazine assignments, interviewing such notables as Stephen Hawking and race car legend Dan Gurney, for the likes of Rolling Stone, Car and Driver, to Sports Illustrated. He finished and sold his first documentary to Discovery by the time he was 28, and has since completed and distributed TV projects to Sci-Fi, TLC, National Geographic, and the History Channel. Tonight, we're going to be discussing his new film, The Phenomenon. James, welcome. How are you tonight?
One hell of an intro. Thank you, sir.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for coming on. You know, The Phenomenon, if you haven't seen it yet, it was fantastic. And to me, it presents the most profound UFO cases with some of the most credible testimony from military and government officials to an entire elementary school. And it also comes out at a time that there appears to be a huge uptick when it comes to talk of UFOs in the mainstream media from government officials. And your film is presented in a way that really will make even the most skeptical people pay attention. I really thought it was great. But before we get too far into it, I'd like to know a little bit more about your background and what really got you started making documentaries and interested in the UFO phenomenon.
Well, thank you, by the way, for that intro. And thank you for having me on.
Of course.
My father was a quadriplegic with multiple sclerosis most of my adult life, and he lost the use of his legs and then eventually his arms when I was quite young. But he was a journalist, and my father traveled around the world, and so I came along with him at a very early age. I was his secretary, his nurse, his chauffeur, and so I got to travel around the world doing cool stuff, cool stories, and I got to sort of have an inside look into journalism earlier than I would have otherwise. I was never that keen on following my father's footsteps in terms of becoming a writer. I always felt my dad was much brighter than I was. It just wasn't my cup of tea. but I did, you know, the advent of the video camera came about when I was, you know, late teens, early 20s. And I thought that was magnificent, because before the video camera, you had to do film, get it processed. It's really expensive. So I thought, what a wonderful tool. And I picked up the camera, I think 19 years old, and I never put it down. I was doing PSAs, public service announcements for AIDS awareness. I was doing little short films on migratory songbirds. And eventually I became interested in the UFO phenomenon. I thought it was kind of crazy at first, but then I went to a few conferences at the insistence of a very dear friend of mine from high school, and I thought, wow, this is interesting. Maybe there's a lot more to this than weather balloons and swamp gas. And so I decided that in my mid-20s to do a film on the topic.
Now, did you have any other personal experiences? Have you ever seen any UFOs or had any strange paranormal phenomenon occurring in your life?
I mean, I just went aboard a flying saucer once. Other than that, not really. You know what I mean? No, it's funny. I don't get asked that question very often. Sometimes I do, And I don't like to answer it because I feel like it could come across as though I have it's influenced where my position is on the topic today. It hasn't. I did have a sighting with a girlfriend of mine years ago. The interesting thing was it was right outside our bedroom window. I had no interest in the topic at all at the time. It was very close. I mean, it was a sort of egg-shaped orb thing. And I remember she noticed it first, and Lisa was like, "What the F is that?" And I looked out the window, and I said, "I don't know what that is, but whatever it is, I get the intention it knows we're looking at it." And she said, "I feel exactly the same thing. I don't like it. Close the blinds." So I leapt up out of bed and fumbled around. I remember I actually ripped the blinds right off the wall onto the floor, and I'm picking them up, trying to put them back on the wall. And my sister came home probably like an hour later. She'd been at a concert. My sister was 2 years older than me. And we told her what happened. It was about midnight by then, maybe 1 a.m. Because she's like, "Oh, you guys look freaked out. What's going on?" We told her. Interesting thing was, we woke up the next morning. We never spoke of it ever again. Didn't even tell my father at the time. How weird is that? In fact, 20 years later, I called my sister. I said, "Janine," because I was almost doubting my own memory, going, "Janine, did I? What are you?" You know, she goes, "Oh, yeah, I came home," and she told me the whole story. Then I bumped into Lisa all these years later, and she had a husband with a daughter. And I asked her, "Lisa, what do you remember?" And of course, she remembered everything like I did. So, yeah, to answer your question, I had that one weird experience. I have no idea what it was I saw, and that's about it.
Well, that's fair enough. Very interesting. Now, right now, it seems that we are seeing a mainstream uptick once again when it comes to media coverage and now official documents and testimony from military personnel, officials, pilots. And they are extremely compelling, especially with the Tic Tac footage that has come out. It somewhat resembles the UFO craze in the late 40s through the 50s that had huge worldwide coverage on the media sightings before Project Blue Book comes along and kind of shuts everything down, and we're pretty quiet for years. But your film starts with some of the earliest testimony and most compelling from these military personnel and officials, and basically just the most extremely credible witnesses you could find, right?
Look, yes. We went to great lengths. I felt like the first half of the film is there to add credibility to the second half. Because honestly, if I succeeded at penetrating a much broader mainstream audience, which is clearly the objective here, I'm not gonna preach to the proverbial choir, let's take something that we can share with the outsiders, so to speak, that's presentable and say, "Hey, look, we're not crazy. You know, I've been talking about UFOs for quite some time now. Check out this movie. This is, you know, a sort of one-stop shop for, you know, UFOs 101. I mean, we start with the modern-day UFO wave of 1940s, and we end with, you know, with a landing case that occurred in Africa. Of course, we include the revelations of the front page of the New York Times, the secret UFO Pentagon program, and all the key players that were involved with that. And so you could literally get an education on UFOs in 97 minutes and be pretty well up to speed. Now, I have seen some criticism out there. You know, I don't care. Well, you get criticized anytime you do anything public, but from the, you know, hardcore UFO buffs, and I'm like, I get it, but don't look at it that way. Don't look at it, this was done for you. Look at it, this is a tool that you can take to your family and say, "Look, I told you I'm not crazy." So that was our objective. And we put a lot of never before seen archival material. Anytime I did a historical bit of, covered a bit of history, I included something new, like Kenneth Arnold. I interviewed his daughter. That was a huge coup to get her on camera for the first time. And you don't even want to know what I went through. William Nash and Fortenberry case of 1952, right before the White House was buzzed. No historian has ever seen the interview with William Nash before, the commercial airline pilot, the guy that was in the radar room the night Al Chop, the night UFOs flew over the White House in the Capitol building, two consecutive weekends in July, 1952. Even As far as the 1952 press conference with General John Sanford, tell me, have you ever seen better footage of that?
Like, yes, yeah, it was great.
What I went through to get, I contacted the owner of CBS to find the original film footage to have it transferred. It's beautiful. So I just hope that people realize that this was done for all of us and also for the larger picture of creating something that's palatable for mainstream media and those that are not familiar with the phenomenon.
And as far as the first half of the film goes, you mentioned, testimony from people such as Kenneth Arnold, William Nash. What were your favorites? And if the audience isn't familiar, maybe tell us a little bit about each case, maybe the Kenneth Arnold case and some of the most compelling for you.
Okay, well, I mean, look, I don't know if your audience is familiar with the UFO phenomenon. I'm assuming they kind of are.
Yes, I'm pretty sure they're pretty well-versed.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. Look, I am too. I mean, this is my fourth film on the topic. And people say, oh, well, I've seen that case before. Yeah, but have you heard it from Al Chop? Because I'll give you an example. July 1952, two consecutive weekends, UFOs buzzed the White House and the Capitol building, Washington, D.C., okay? They scrambled jets to intercept. We got all the original headlines. We got audio recordings. And then we have an interview with a gentleman named Al Chop, who is in the radar room the night one of the jets intercepted and caught up with these unknown objects over the Capitol and over the White House and over that whole area. Hearing his testimony, because we've never heard from the pilots, but hearing someone who heard the voice of the pilot, someone who spoke to the pilot after the incident, and hearing what he said, do you know what it's like to fly at roughly 600 miles an hour in the pitch darkness and suddenly find yourself surrounded by unknowns? I mean, just put yourself in that pilot's shoes for a moment. I mean, the Air Force went to great lengths to make damn sure that we never heard from those pilots. Have you noticed that? Like all this hoopla about it. We got the press conference with General John Sanford at the end of it. All this stuff goes down, but we never hear from the pilots. The media never hears from the pilots. I mean, don't you think that's who you'd want to hear from? Especially if they try to write it off as weather phenomenon. So, you know, that was incredible to me to think about just putting myself in that pilot's shoes. Just before that, there was the Nash and Fortenberry incident where you have two commercial airline pilots flying at, I don't know what their elevation was. I'm going to guess it wasn't that high, 9,000, 10,000 feet. You'd have to look it up. But they had discs, nine of them, fly underneath their plane. And they could see the ground and they could see the lake. It was a lake or an inlet below them. But so they had a point of reference and they could judge the speed of these objects. And they flew in and then did an extremely right angle turn without slowing down and flew out. It's an absolutely fascinating case that took place in 1952. And then of course you've got the landing case in Australia in 1966 at a school. Most Americans have never heard of that case. I certainly hadn't. You know, you've got over 250 witnesses in broad daylight of an object landing. That's incredible.
I do want to get to that a little bit later, but what would you say to the people, to the, you know, extreme skeptics that say even back then that these were just maybe experimental aircraft from the Soviets or different countries that were working on, or even our experimental aircraft that we were just covering up? You know, it seems to me that some of the testimony of the speed and the way these things were moving would be impossible for any of our technology to have been that sophisticated back then. What are your thoughts on that?
We have the former Assistant Deputy Secretary of Defense for Intelligence, Christopher Mellon, who said, is there just in the movie, and he said it to me personally as well, we don't have that today, even on the drawing board, okay? That's today. If you listen to David Fravor, the Navy fighter pilot off the coast of San Diego, who played cat and mouse with this tic-tac egg, whatever you want to call it, the exhibited technology of an object that has the ability to hover, accelerate from a standstill to out of sight in literally the blink of an eye, right angle turns at high speed, no wings, no tail, no visible means of propulsion whatsoever, no exhaust vents. It's light years advanced from us. And you can listen to the same testimony of a World War II pilot who was a colonel in the United States Air Force, William T. Coleman, who also was public spokes officer for Project Blue Book, which is the investigatory arm of the Air Force into UFOs, talk about the same absorbed technology in 1955 over at Alabama. So look, if someone has been hiding this technology for 75 years, when you think about the implications of the advantage that we could have in the military, if you could harness this technology, if we had this technology, just think about it, you could rule the world. So I talked to the military and government officials all around the world. They're like, this is not us.
Yeah, and even back then, you showed in the film these official documents that military officials were taking this as a very serious threat at the time. You wouldn't hear about these documents coming out until recently, but they were taking this very seriously for a period of time, right?
Look, you go look at the Socorro 1964 UFO landing case with witness police officer Lonnie Zamora, okay? We uncover all the Air Force internal documentation as part of Project Blue Book, the original files from the Air Force's own Project Blue Book files, okay? You can see from Richard T. Holder, who's the first military officer on the scene, plus Project Blue Book goes there, Dr. Jalen Hynek, scientific advisor to Project Blue Book. This is the most well-documented close encounter of the third kind in U.S. history. So you've got a credible witness, a police officer in uniform on duty, reporting not just a UFO, he called it an egg, Fravor called it a tic-tac, no wings, no tail, no visible means of propulsion, never dissolved, But he claimed to see beings as well. So you can make the argument just on technology alone, but you take it a step further, and then you have these close encounters of the third kind, which the Air Force took very seriously as early back as 1964, where they've even documented the landing site and built and drew diagrams. We feature these in the film, where you can see they knew where the footprints were in relation to the landed UFO of these occupants, and they were exactly where Lonnie had said they were. They took the case very seriously. They took the officer in, they interrogated him, talked to him about it. They knew it was a close encounter of the third kind. They knew what they were dealing with. So, it's difficult for the Air Force, I understand, because they're kind of in a very tough spot. When your job is the security of our airspace, and you've got objects, technological objects, engineered objects of unknown origin, whizzing around our airspace with impunity, flying rings around our fastest jets, you don't know who they are, where they come from, or what they want. Shall they turn to be hostile? I'm not saying they are, but shall they did turn to be hostile, you've got no visible means of defense against them. That's a very difficult thing to disclose to the general public. So you can kind of see, I hate to say it, but you can kind of see why they were reluctant to go, this is what's going on. We don't know who they are.
Right. And when you're talking about compelling documents, you also had a part of the film where the great scientist and ufologist Jacques Vallée found a document that he claimed changed his life forever. Talk a little bit about that.
It's interesting. Not that many people pluck that out from the documentary, but a handful of real true researchers do. And so I'm glad you noticed that, because that was a tricky document. And quite honestly, if it wasn't for Jacques' insistence, we were like, are we going to mention this? But Jacques really said, you don't understand. Like, this is There are so many documents out there that are not legitimate. This is a bona fide, legitimate document that I personally uncovered, and I personally got declassified. It took them great lengths to do it. But what it revealed is that during times of Project Blue Book was a parallel, super secret, super well-funded UFO program, Project Stork. The memos, I think, is signed by referred to the Cross memo. But basically, it's a super secret, underground, highly classified UFO program where they were taking this topic extremely serious, and it made you realize that Project Blue Book was just nothing more than a dog and pony show. And that's why it changed Jacques' perspective and his whole world, because they were doing exactly what he would have liked to have been doing at that time, but they were doing it completely underground, stealth, off the radar.
Right. And, you know, when you're speaking of Project Blue Book, I was just about to ask you about that because, you know, it to me, it was just from the get-go, it was just a reason to kind of silence the whole phenomenon. They just put the, you know, Hynek and his crew out there to debunk everything. And the best part for me was when Hynek finally turned around and started, you know, believing in the phenomenon and going against it. And you talked a good bit about this in the film, and I thought it was a great addition for it.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, one of the secret little behind the scenes stories that we did not reveal in the movie was that Jacques Vallée was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in April of 1964. I believe it was the only time he ever got a full tour of the base. And he was there with Dr. Hynek, and he was trying to tell Hynek, look, you've got to look at these Project Blue Book files that have been classified as psychological, because those are close encounters of the third kind cases. And they're just quickly dismissing them because they don't know how to categorize. That's just too out there for the Air Force, right? And he was telling Hynek all this stuff about cases that were happening in France at the time, and these, you know, reported beings that were associated with the craft. And then literally 2 days later, Hynek gets a phone call landing in Socorro, and off he went. And Dr. Vallée said that changed everything for Hynek. That case made him realize that we were truly dealing with something otherworldly.
Yeah, that was awesome. Now something I want to get into is really fascinating for me is how these UFOs, or whatever they may be, have a history of shutting down nuclear devices and nuclear plants and things of this nature. And you covered that in the film as well, and you covered a couple of different instances. The first one was Ellsworth, and then we have Bentwaters. Could you talk a little bit about those cases?
Yes. So, funny enough, let me back up a little bit, because we were in the studio, and I had a couple, I'm an editor myself, but I had a couple of other people that were editing with me, and my buddy Lance Mungia, he did a film, Third Eye Spy, about the secret CIA spy, psychic spy program, and he came to edit with me up north. He lived in Southern California. And he came up with a really good idea when we were listening to like these archival UFO encounter reports from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Then we had some really compelling stuff that had taken place at Holloman, White Sands, and areas of Texas and Socorro, just all around those areas. He goes, James, you know, we should get a map, and we should put little pins on the map and just see where everything is, you know, places. And I thought, hey, great idea. So he got the map. I think he ordered one online, and we started putting in the map. And what we noticed was that a lot of the cases that were happening during that time were all around Trinity Site. Trinity Site in New Mexico is where we detonated the first atomic bomb back in 1945. I mean, Socorro, New Mexico is 44 miles from Trinity Site. You've got what was part of the White Sands testing range. I think it was all the way to the north. And you got White Sands, Holloman, and you just had all that hub of activity in that region. And we thought that was rather interesting. We definitely thought there was a correlation with this activity and the atomic activity and the dawn of the atomic age. And that was the epicenter of it all. And lo and behold, there was all this UFO activity. So fast forward, we didn't really we took note, but we didn't really do a whole lot more than that. In fact, I'm not even sure. Well, we might have mentioned it a little bit, but not that much. Anyway, fast forward, and I'm meeting with Senator Harry Reid, who was the one that spearheaded the ATIP, Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, that wound up on the front page of the New York Times in December of 2017. And I had a wonderful sit down with Senator Reid, and he had a very limited time with him. I mean, he had a window like this, and he's like, okay, I'm showing up at this time, and I'm leaving at this time. And when it got down to just a few minutes left, and I could see he's got security detail, he's got he's got a whole entourage of people that travel with him. I mean, you knew when he entered the room, it was like you're in the presence of a very powerful man. And I said, Senator, would you mind terribly if we could do a quick walk and talk B-roll shot, because just in case we need it for the editing in the studio. He understood. He goes, yeah, we can do that. He goes, got a couple minutes. Let's. So I looked at my camera guy and I said, hey, don't worry about audio. Don't worry about lighting. Let's just get what we can get in the hallway over here. So while I'm walking with him in the hallway, I said, I figured, well, I might as well take advantage of the time. I was standing next to Senator Harry Reid. So I said, Senator, with all due respect, would you mind telling me, was there any particular aspect of the phenomenon that you guys uncovered that really got your attention during the ATIP Pentagon program? And he said, yes, and without hesitation, he said, the fact that they're not only incursions over super secret nuclear weapons facilities, but that in some cases they were shutting these weapons off. In very rare instances, they were activating them. But he said, he went as far as to say a couple cases that he was aware of that if the president had called to launch, he couldn't have done it. And I thought, did I just hear that straight? I mean, I can't believe the level of coming from this man that he's talking about. Look, it's one thing to see. I mean, people think of UFOs, they think, oh, this blurry, ambiguous light off in the distance. Now we're dealing with a level of confirmation of the fact they exist, and the fact that these guys are shutting off our nukes, these incursions all over our the most secret, secure military installations on Earth, and they're just flying in, shutting stuff off. So I said, okay, we need to look into this. And I'd heard about it in the past, not like I was blind to it, but having that level of confirmation from a gentleman of that stature, it was like, okay. So I reached out to Robert Hastings, who wrote, he's the godfather of UFOs and nukes. And he made all of his research available to us. And I think we spent the better part of a year putting together a very poignant, 8 to 10 minute back-to-back testimonies of these high-ranking military officers whose job was the security of nuclear weapons. I mean, it doesn't get any higher level than that. And it's absolutely fascinating. In fact, most people that see the film for the first time, just between that and the landing in Africa at the end, they say, I just had a paradigm shift. You just changed my whole world, so it's fascinating stuff.
It is. And it makes me wonder, a lot of the phenomena seem to have an uptick after we started testing and using nuclear weapons. I'd like to get your thoughts on why they are coming. Do you think they're giving us a warning, telling us, hey, what are you messing with here? You shouldn't be doing this, and just shutting it down just to tell us, look what we can do. So, be careful what you do on your planet. That's, I think, the message that they're sending.
What was your first clue? No. Launch control officer, Colonel Robert Salas, put it to me. I met with him in person. And I was just gobsmacked by the whole thing. And he said, well, to me, the message is pretty clear. He's very calm. You could realize why this guy was a launch control officer for nuclear weapons, because he had nerves of steel and nothing got him excited. He was very calm. stable. His delivery was smooth and calm and measured. And he said, James, pretty obvious to me, just like taking matches out of the hands of a baby.
Very well said.
I can't add to that.
Yeah, that was very well said. Now, you know, we move ahead a little bit in your film to after the Cold War, where Russians are trying to gain a little bit of a relationship with America and share information of about UFOs, of all things. And they invite George Knapp over to kind of go over some UFO documentation. I thought that was very interesting because that's something you don't hear about very often either. And I enjoyed that part of the film as well. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, kind of what went down between us and the Soviet Union after the Cold War when it comes to UFOs?
Well, first and foremost, I've got to do this. This is to George Knapp. Nothing but respect for that man. That guy's, people have no idea what that guy does behind the scenes. That guy's a force to be reckoned with. I mean, he's pulling levers all over the place. I mean, he's the most well-connected. Look, the off the record conversations I've had with him, we all have should be grateful for all the hard work and dedication that guy's done for the field. Cause wow. George Knapp went, there was a window of government transparency that was happening. Like wall of secrecy was coming down, and he was invited to Russia in 1993. And he said it was just one of those rare moments where they pulled back the curtain, and it seemed like they were willing to, shed light on this mystery and cooperate with us and reveal what a lot of what they knew, along with, you know, videotaped recordings of radar confirmation of these objects, with government documents and on-camera testimony. So it was a very, very rare moment in history where the Soviets were opening up and discussing this stuff publicly. And we managed to get access to that 1993 trip. It was done for KLAS, in Las Vegas. And we feature some of it in the film, and it's amazing. I mean, look, this is a global phenomenon. I mean, like, I went to China. I mean, same things are happening in China. I mean, there's a landing case in China in 1994, the same year as the landing case in Africa, Rua, Zimbabwe, and the witness monk Zhao Gua claimed the same message that they got in Africa in the same year. So look, it's a global phenomenon. The observed technology is described identically in, you know, 50 different languages or more. It's happening everywhere.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. And you also get into the presidential aspect of disclosure, where we've seen over and over many presidents telling us, they're going to look into the phenomenon. They're going to get behind us and release some information for us. And you actually had some clips of Bill Clinton talking about this. We recently had Trump saying, yeah, he'll look into this a little bit. But it never seems to get anywhere. We always have that initial response, yeah, of course, we're going to look into it, and then crickets. Do you think that presidents are at some point just told, nope, it's not going to happen, you're not going to say anything about it? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the presidents are told to kick rocks. I really do. And I'm not just saying that. It's informed speculation. It's beyond informed speculation. I mean, I've talked to Jimmy Carter, Gerald Ford, I interviewed back in the 90s. You know, I know that Gerald Ford was furious at the swamp gas explanation that happened at the landing cases in Michigan in 1966. And as a result of that, he raised hell, and they eventually had congressional hearings. Of course, he later became president of the United States. And that was the thing that, you know, when I had him on the telephone, he didn't want to go into at all. Don't talk to me about when I was president. Why would he say that? You know, Jimmy Carter, remember, he had his own sighting. When I become president, I'll release files. He actually did release a lot of FOIA stuff, you know, but in terms of talking about what happened, he said he made inquiries. I actually got him on camera talking about it. I basically what he alluded to was, we made inquiries. We were not happy with the answers we were getting. I heard the same thing from John Podesta with President Clinton. And I heard from people part of the ATIP program that clearly confirmed for me that they don't share a lot of the stuff with any president. And in particular, they mentioned Trump because they were concerned about it winding up on Twitter.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That would be a definite concern with Trump's Twitter habits.
Yeah. But it kind of makes sense. You think about 75 years of secrecy, right? And you get an elected official, a minimum of 4 years, a maximum of 8 years for the presidency. You're going to debrief him on 75 years of history, and then he's going to become a civilian again, like 4 years or 8 years later. You know, I could kind of see why they wouldn't do that. And look, I'm sure the vast majority of the stuff today is probably in the private sector anyway. So, that's just my two cents.
Right. And you mentioned in 2017 when the ATIP program, when the media kind of got wind of it, that's when everything started blowing up and picking up again. But to this day, we're still hearing, more and more UFO talk in the media and the mainstream. And now we have a Space Force that, of course, President Trump is talking about. Do you think that we're ever going to have any further kind of disclosure coming from our government, which I personally don't see it happening? I think it's going to be up to, independent researchers like yourself and others that are going to bring this to the forefront. But what do you see happening with this modern disclosure? We have the TTSA. We have all the talk on the mainstream media. Navy pilots and officials are able to report this now. So it seems that things are changing, but I'm not sure to what extent.
Well, I think it's a very good point. And keep in mind that it's much more difficult for those in power, whoever they might be, whoever the people that are covering this up might be, less and less convinced. It's not part of our elected officials. They were probably squeezed out maybe in the 50s or 60s. And there are people within the inside that have had the curtain pulled back enough to recognize there is a significant amount of evidence that is yet to be released. I was incredibly encouraged to see Senator Reid, confirm some of those things for us. It was part of this ATIP program. You've got Lou Elizondo, who made a massive sacrifice with his career because he couldn't, he felt that the general public, the world, was entitled to this information and they needed to take it seriously and make things more public. You've got people like Christopher Mellon that are working diligently behind the scenes. You've got an assessment that's coming down the pike soon at any day, probably after the election. And it's going to be more difficult for the government, and I say the government, but to, tell an informed public that, we're dealing with swamp gas and misidentified aircraft. And that's one of the reasons why we put a little call to action at the end of the film. Because we wanted, people to feel like there is something that you can do, that Joe Public can do, and I consider myself Joe Public as well, but you can notify your representative and just say, hey, you don't have to raise hell or anything, but say, hey, we'd like to see more government transparency, because the representatives need to hear from their constituents before they're going to just put their neck out, right? Because it's not exactly a career-enhancing move for these politicians, right? I mean, look, they're curious, just as curious as the next guy. Okay, I handed out 535 copies of my film out of the blue to each and every member of the House and Senate. I mean, I addressed it to their chief of staff, and because that's the person I dealt with. And I found it tremendous on both parties. Look, this is an apolitical, non-political, issue, which is very exciting. It's really, both parties were, they meet me in the hallway and go, we're so fascinated about this. Like, yeah, my God, I can't wait to check this out, and we want to see somebody do it. But they basically said to me, they were not going to take serious action. Now, a lot has changed since then, but if this still makes sense today, they're not going to take action without the support of their constituents. Simple as that. So we can do something. You know, we can do something. We don't just sit on the sidelines and wait for something to get done. You know, you get in the trenches and do something. And we're all capable of doing that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the more that, you know, independent researchers and people get on that train and start doing that, the faster things will move along. Now, in your film, when you were sitting down and talking to Senator Harry Reid, that was one of my favorite parts, especially when he said that there is so many documents about this that has never seen the light of day and probably never will. It just makes me think, how many stacks or rooms or how much do they have that we are not seeing and that they already know about, which is insane to me, because, you know, that could be anything. And the amount of technology that they could already be working on could, you know, possibly change our future forever and we wouldn't know it.
You know, that was a moment for me when I met with Harry Reid, because, you know, there have only been a handful of those moments in my life career with, and I've made 4.5 movies on this topic. I say 4.5 because I spent another 2.5 years on Out of the Blue after I finished it after 5 years, and I spent another 2.5 years on it. So I spent 7.5 years on Out of the Blue, it's two different versions. So I feel like that was kind of a half doc. But, and I had a couple of wow moments, and that was one of those wow moments. And I wasn't sure how far I could push his comfort zone. I didn't know where it was. And honestly, you have to keep in mind, I was worried about him just getting up and leaving. I mean, I could have said something that triggered, you know, like violation of Secrecy Act. I don't know. I mean, you know, maybe gone beyond his comfort and he terminates the interview. So I was very cautious. But as we got more relaxed and we got 30, 40 minutes into it, I had brought up my meeting with Gordon Cooper back in the 90s. Gordon Cooper was the last American astronaut to go up in space alone, Mercury, Gemini. And he confirmed for me on camera, it's in a couple of my movies, that there was a landing case. I don't know if you want me to go into details of this, but there was basically a landing case that happened circa 1957 at Edwards Air Force Base. And that he had a camera crew out documenting the installation of, I think it was a F-86 fighter jet installation, landing facility pad, something like this. And it was broad daylight. And they noticed a disc-shaped object, and they turned their cameras on it, and it landed on the dry lake bed, and it sat there for a moment. They started to walk towards it, and then it lifted off. He said he put the gear in the well, and then it just shot off at a high rate of speed. Well, Gordon Cooper didn't personally, put the film in a reel and, you know, play it, but he said he had it developed, held it up, looked at it, perfectly good film, broad daylight, disc on the tarmac, on the lake bed. All the while this whole process is unfolding, eventually he gets higher and higher and higher up the rank. A courier jet comes in from Washington and picks up this footage. Well, this was like at the peak of Project Blue Book, 1957. And we don't know it to be exactly, we're pretty sure it was 1957. And I brought this story up with Senator Reid. And, you know, I mean, come on, I'm talking about a filming of a flying saucer at a dry lake bed at Edwards Air Force Base. I mean, you know, I'm a little like, oh, God, I hope this doesn't backfire. And just as I said, Gordon Cooper told me on camera that he handed this footage over to this courier jet, people that flew in from Washington. And he interrupts me and says, and it was never seen or heard from again. And I went, exactly.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I said, yeah, exactly. And then and then he tries to change the subject and talk about something else. And I said, well, hold on a minute. I said, Senator, are you suggesting that there's evidence that hasn't seen the light of day? And it seemed like an hour, but it was probably just a few seconds. I was like, all right, well, where's this going? He picks up his water bottle, takes a sip, puts the cap on, and he says, I'm saying that most of the evidence hasn't seen the light of day. And that was like a...
Yeah, that was an amazing moment.
it confirms what we've all suspected. You know, people that, well, you know, I've been acutely aware of all the different testimony from the military guys that I've talked with, from radar tapes to cockpit recording tapes to photographs and filmed footage, you know, from Vandenberg Air Force Base, that guy Robert Jacobs talks about that incredible Atlas rocket and the thing beaming the lights at it and the dummy warhead falling out of the sky. I mean, fascinating stuff. So you know that they didn't just throw that stuff in a garbage can. I mean, come on, you don't just do that. So there's a repository somewhere, and then you get that confirmation from Senator Reid, and I couldn't believe it. It was a great moment.
Yeah, it was. Now we have a few minutes left. I'd like you to talk about the exotic materials that you showed that you were testing in the film. A little bit about the origins and what exactly it was, and what the results were of these testing of these materials.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
Good answer.
So I had to joke a bit with that one. So we were probably working with Jacques for about a year. Never said a word about what he was doing in the lab in Silicon Valley. I mean, the guy was just, I had no idea. And he would come out to this little wooden shack that we edited this movie in that had no running water, no toilet. It was at the end of a dirt road. It's a long story how we ended up doing it, but that's the way it worked out. And we had a little power cord that ran from the house of the woman that in this garden that I was renting the space from. And it was supposed to be just a temporary installation for us to transition until I could find something that I could afford in my area, because I got a son and I have to be able to pick him up from school, so I couldn't go too far. And I live in the country. Long story short, we ended up staying in this little wooden shack. And Jacques would come out and he'd spend marathon edits with us out in this little shack. And we'd joke about it. And he would bring, like, I'd say, bring your compass and your bear spray. And he'd say, I got my camo on. I got my compass. He'd come out. And after about a year, he said, I got to talk to you about something. And I said, okay, great. Sure. He said, well, we need to do it in person. I said, oh, great. Let's get together. We did. And he said, doing a little stuff in a lab at Silicon Valley with a guy named Gary Nolan. And I thought that, you know, we'll talk a little bit about it on camera for the movie. I said, great. Yeah. Tell me more. He's like, well, we've got this state-of-the-art new device that looks at things at the atomic level. Apparently, it's some revolutionary device technology that Gary Nolan has, you know, been putting together. I wouldn't even want to guess what the price tag of the device is, but it's very serious looking. And Dr. Vallée has been collecting material from cases dating back to 47. And, you know, for decades, he's been traveling around the world, meeting with witnesses all over. So he's got them, you know, he's in a vault. And their preliminary analysis, and mind you, people say, well, you didn't give us enough information. I was like, well, it's not up to me. You're dealing with scientists that need peer review. They need to be published in a scientific journal, and everything needs to be cross-checked. And but they did say, look, these preliminary results are startling. We're dealing with something that's engineered at an atomic level, and we don't understand it. In fact, to duplicate it would be in the billions. And even if we could duplicate it. And I thought that was incredibly fascinating, because you're talking about physical evidence that could be replicated and analyzed in a lab. So, you know, the implications there are startling. But we had to be very conservative. They had to be conservative. Gary Nolan works at Stanford University. I mean, look, he can't just go out making wild allegations, wild claims without, you know, backing those things up. And they're in the process of doing that. Unfortunately, Gary got notification from the White House to study the coronavirus. And so he's been in a hazmat suit for months now in a lab looking at the coronavirus. So that slowed the process down a little bit.
I got you. Yeah, it's very fascinating. I encourage
I'd say.
everyone to go and watch this film. It is so great. I have one more question for you before we let you go. Now, the last section of the film was also one of my favorites when you covered the sighting in 1994 in Zimbabwe. Yes, it is so profound that an entire, basically entire schoolyard full of children saw the same thing. Their reactions when being interviewed, the story, all their stories matched, and you know, being able to talk to them again as they're adults and recall the story, I found that to be just an amazing part of the film. And for those that aren't familiar, it's basically in 1994, this whole schoolyard, a craft landed, and beings got out of the craft, and these children witnessed and psychically communicated with these beings, right?
How much time do I have?
You've got a little over 10 minutes or so.
All right, so I'll back up a little bit. I was producing my first documentary in the 90s, UFOs, 50 Years of Denial. And I was naive enough at the time in my mid-20s to think that I could get an interview with Steven Spielberg. And I had a mutual friend through my father, this woman, Janet Yang. And, you know, so I reached out through her. It was a kind of a big favor because I'm sure she got hit up for this all the time. She got back to me, I think, within a week or two. And she's like, yeah, he's not going to meet with you. But he does want you to know. And remind you, this was back in 1997. This is the information coming to me in 1997. And the incident that I'm about to tell you about was 1994, 3 years earlier. He doesn't want to tell you. You're doing a film on the topic of UFOs. You might want to look into what he considers the most compelling close encounter of the third kind in history, ever, record modern history. And it took place at a school in Africa. And that's pretty much all I heard. And you know, look, a close encounter of the third kind to your audience, and I'm sure they're familiar with, but those of you who are not, is when the witness or witnesses in this case claim to see beings associated with the flying saucers or the UFO or UFOs. Well, I said to myself, it was like a knee-jerk reaction. I mean, it was so quick. It was like, you know, I'm not going to look into that because my feeling was, and my level of conviction was 100%, there's no way that a landing and a close encounter of the third kind can take place with that sheer volume of eyewitness testimony and the whole world not know about it. I'm sorry, but I just forget about it. I didn't look into it for 10 years. Fast forward 2007, I'm doing the National Press Club event with Leslie Kane. I made a movie about it called I Know What I Saw. And I meet a gentleman, Randall Nickerson, who's working on that case alone. And that kind of piqued my interest a little bit. And eventually I looked at there was a Harvard psychiatrist by the name of Dr. John Mack, who flew in to Harare, which is the capital of Zimbabwe, and he drove out to the school in Rua, rural area, aerial school, and he interviewed roughly 66 children. Now, people think that there were only 66 witnesses. There were actually 100 witnesses, and there were adults all over the town for several days that saw the UFOs. The UFOs just happened to choose the school to land, and the occupants get out. God only knows why. This object or objects landed during morning recess, roughly about 10 a.m. The occupants, and some say there was one, most kids say there was more than one, most kids say there was more than one UFO, but, you know, the experience was just a little different for all the kids because some of them saw two UFOs, some of them saw more than one. But you can imagine if you see one being, you're so fixated, you know, you don't even think to look to see if there's other beings. And this Harvard psychiatrist interviews 66 out of the roughly 100 children that were in the playground that day. And the testimony from these children is, to say profoundly moving would be the world's biggest understatement. They're drawing the same thing. They're describing the same thing. It was broad daylight. It lasted between 12 and 15 minutes. And then we track down the students with the help of this guy, Randall Nickerson, who's been working on a film. He's actually got a film coming out that's produced by Dan Farrow. He's one of our producers. He's one of the producers, I think, next year on this, which just deals with just this case alone. And they say the same thing as adults. In fact, they've had more time, obviously 20 years, to really think about, you know, their experience and process their experience, and then talk about the message that they received. They apparently received a message, the children, according to them, of environmental destruction, devastation, things of that are kind of what we're experiencing today, back in 1994 in rural Africa.
Right. That was extremely compelling, and I love the way that it ended on that story. Now, a final thought from you. Do you think that these beings are a threat? Are they friends? Or maybe both? Some threat, some friends. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, look, I've talked to a lot of military guys about the observed technology, and they said right away, look, man, if this thing wanted to do me harm, it would have been no problem, because this thing flew rings around me, man. And I interviewed the former governor of Arizona, Fife Symington, when he witnessed that massive UFO flyover from March of 1997. He's a captain in the Air Force, pilot. He said he looked up at that thing and he was like, holy moly, just the sheer size of it, the technology. He was like, I wasn't scared, because I, you know, if they were here to do us harm, we'd know it. And so, you know, you have testimonials like that. And then you have the children saying that they were not scared at all. In fact, they said the encounter was benign. I mean, it was more like these beings were just as curious about the children as the children were with them. And it was this very beautiful sort of moment, this standoff moment of observation and curiosity and mystery. So again, you know, there are going to be people out there that disagree with what I'm saying, but from the witnesses that I've talked to, both civilian and military and government officials, we have nothing to worry about.
Yeah, I think I would agree with you for the most part. You know, even if there are malevolent ETs out there, for the most part, I think they are here for, if not to help us, to at least observe and maybe try and keep us on the right track.
Maybe put a tag in us and watch us a little bit.
Yeah, maybe a little bit. Of that. Who knows?
Hey, kind of what we do in the nature reserve, you know. Hey, right, check that right. One out. Let's put a tag in that thing.
You never know. But James, thank you so much for coming on. I'm going to leave a link to the film in the description. If people want to find out more about you, your other films, and you know, to see the film right now, what's the best way to do so?
So I'm glad you asked. The film is the website is www.thephenomenonfilm.com, thephenomenonfilm.com. There are two platforms. For no extra cost, if you are going to buy it, you can rent it for like $3.99. But if you're going to buy it for like $12.99, iTunes and Vimeo offers 3 hours of bonus material. And it's really great stuff that I put in there, like great historical stuff. So I would highly recommend doing that. The other thing I'd ask your audience, if you wouldn't mind, pretty pleased with Sugar on Top, if you could rate us on Rotten Tomatoes, it's free, it's quick. You can do it through Facebook. Or iTunes, we would greatly appreciate it. It really helps get the word out.
Awesome. I'm going to go leave myself a rating right now.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
All right, James, thank you so much. I'd love to have you back on in the future sometime.
Look forward to it.
All right, have a great night.
Bye.